Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Lawmakers passed a new education law this year. It's designed to provide greater educational opportunities to students throughout the state and reduce property tax burdens by slowing down the growth rate of spending in the years ahead. Londonderry Representative Oliver Olson says it's very important to restrain budget growth in the state's largest communities in order to have a meaningful impact on property tax rates.
If you look at the 15, 20 largest school districts in the state, you'll find that they spend more than the bottom 150 districts in the state. So the challenge is if you only focus on the small districts, yeah, you might be able to restrain spending in those individual districts, but it's going to have very little impact on overall statewide spending and therefore very little impact on property taxes across the state.
Will this new law be able to achieve these goals, and how will some of Vermont's smaller school districts be affected by this legislation? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb. Great to have you back on the program.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, this is a very complicated law. There are probably very few people who really understand it. I thought we could just look at a couple of components to start with and then get your general impressions about the law. It seems like one overarching goal is to provide a new structure for educational governance. Vermont currently has, I think, 277 school districts, and some are quite small. About a third of Vermont school districts have fewer than 100 students. And Vermont's student enrollment has been declining for more than a decade. There are 24,000 fewer students than in 1997. At the same time, overall spending on education has increased pretty dramatically. So the new law calls for school districts to have at least 900 students in order to provide a wide range of educational opportunities. It also has some tax incentives to encourage smaller districts to merge with their neighboring districts. And some smaller districts will be allowed to stay in operation if they can prove that they meet new education quality standards at a reasonable cost. And there's a variable spending threshold to encourage towns to keep their growth rate under 2 or 3%. Many other parts of this law as well. How do you think this law addresses the needs of Vermont schools going forward in the future?
Well, I think you outlined some of the underlying structural challenges that really drove the conversation, and in particular that we are now operating with about 20% fewer students than we used to have 20 years ago. And when you think of the Brigham decision and the subsequent funding legislation that came out of that, the intent was very clear that in Vermont, we are committed to providing a substantively equal education to students. Equal doesn't mean the same, but it does mean that whatever town you're born in, you should have access to the quality education that enables you to achieve whatever dreams and ambitions that you have. And what the funding formula does do is equalize really the ability to raise revenue. So districts who get the same revenue per pupil at a proportional rate, so proportionally to how much they choose to spend. And so that was one piece of the equity goal. But in a case where many systems, and some of our districts are operating with 50% fewer students than they were 20 years ago, some even with 70% fewer students than they were 20 years ago, and those overall declines are concentrated regionally, what it means is that some areas just aren't able to support the kinds of programs to which they're accustomed. So what they're really doing right now is cutting or curtailing the kinds of opportunities and supports that they're able to provide for our children. And at the same time, we know that the demographics of our student population are changing as well. As a system statewide, we are serving more children who are struggling really with the adverse effects of poverty. And that means that some of them are coming to school with less support and less opportunity behind them to enable them to take advantage of the opportunities we do provide. And that brings with it cost. And so what we are hearing from systems is that they really feel challenged and struggling to provide what they feel is high quality education in an equitable way. And what the law is trying to do is provide those systems that know that they have challenges and know they need to rethink their mode of delivery in order to be able to operate, some of the tools to do so that they can reorganize the way they operate in ways that really preserve what their core values are as communities. And in some cases, that means thinking a little bit more broadly about what community is. And one of the reasons that the governor chose to sign the bill, Act 46, at the Smiley School in Bolton was that this is a school where the community did feel very strongly about keeping a small local elementary school. We know from their school board it would have closed but for the merger. And we also know that they, as a system, knew that they shared a very strong vision for equity. And at the high school level, because they had a unified high school, they knew the preparation their individual elementary schools were providing wasn't equitable. Kids were arriving at the middle school with different levels of preparation and having had different opportunities coming through. And they didn't feel that that was right. And they also knew that that was increasing costs and challenges later on. And frankly, you know, when I was up there recently, I spoke to the students, and every student I spoke to could describe inequities in the preparation students had at the elementary level. And one of the board members said, well, when we tolerate that as a system, what we're saying is inequity is okay. And that really was part of it. They really wanted to focus on student outcomes and student opportunities and see how by thinking a little bigger and working together that they could be more powerful as a unit than they would be individually. And that's what this law is intended to support.
So what do you say to the critics of the law who mm-hmm. look at this law as the heavy hand of state government coming down and destroying whatever local control is left in education?
I would ask them if they've read the bill, first of all, because sometimes I find that when I ask people, they haven't actually read the bill and they aren't aware of what it's actually saying. And I think the bill is very clear that it has the goals of quality, equity and sustainability at its core. But I think it also explicitly acknowledges that there is no one size that's going to fit all in Vermont. We know that there are areas of the state that are going to be very difficult. They're not going to be able to reach the preferred structures outlined in the bill. And we're aware of that. And we've already in conversations with many of those areas. But one of the things we really have to remember in Vermont is that we have one education fund. There is no local revenue for education anymore. And one of the ways to help some of those systems that are very small and not able to partake of some of the opportunities outlined for governance reform is that if we can control costs for the system as a whole, we're actually controlling costs for every single individual member. And what we do see is there are places that have had stable enrollments and have really worked hard to maintain a level budget and are still seeing increases in their tax rate. And that's partly a function of growing costs statewide. Somebody has to raise the revenue to support that. And so what we really need to remember is that because we have a statewide education fund, we're all in this together, and we have to all be invested in the efficiency and the ability to deliver equity at an affordable price and quality at an affordable price in every single system in the state.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about this new education bill that calls for smaller districts to merge with their neighbors, expand educational opportunities? Do you think there are other steps that should be taken to improve the quality of education in Vermont? And do some smaller schools in Vermont offer their students a wide enough range of opportunities? Or is that difficult to do when you have 12 to 15 students in the senior class? Your thoughts about education in Vermont, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You know, there's some of the state's smaller school districts who think they actually provide a very wide range of educational opportunities to their students. They think they've got a great quality of education. They don't see a need to merge with a larger district. So what about those schools?
You know, I think what we have here is an opportunity in every location to actually look at where we are, what we want for our children, and how well our future is aligned with that. And I do hear that, but I also do hear that from some districts that have, for example, a substantial number of phantom students. And these are the students for which you're reimbursed currently, the hold harmless students under the funding formula, but which over time are leaving your system, so they won't be there, and you won't be compensated for those students down the road. I was talking to one school board member, and I asked him, what are you doing to plan now for the time when you're budget isn't subsidized by the students that you have that are really phantom students because they had a very high number. And he asked me, what do you mean? And my point is we need to understand that in some of these towns, they're looking at tax rate increases, 10%, as high as even in some cases 60%, associated just with losing those students from their systems. And so the real issue is not, are you doing well today? The real issue is looking at where you are, what you care about passionately as a community. What are you doing now to plan for a future to make sure you can deliver on those goals for your kids down the road? And in some of these communities, they will be doing it with fewer students than they currently have sitting in their classrooms today. And so the issue is, you know, we have this extraordinary opportunity, and the bill has given some of these systems tools to do it, to take advantage now, to think and plan for a future for our children when we're not in crisis. And that's what I would ask those systems to do.
We got this email from Ellen who writes us, I think the school merger law is very poorly thought out. First of all, we're a small rural state, and for the most part, we have small rural schools. The law should have looked at distance rather than student numbers when calculating who should be merged. Maine recently had a forced consolidation of supervisory unions. Fewer superintendents were supposed to save money. They're now spending more than ever because a whole layer of assistants to the superintendents were hired. Bigger bureaucracy also costs more, and this will happen here in Vermont. As you look at the experience of Maine, which sounds like it hasn't been all that positive, is there something for Vermont to learn from that experience?
Well, I think the bill is very different from what Maine tried to do in that I think the bill explicitly acknowledges that the best solutions are developed locally by the people who know their systems and know their communities the best and are accountable for making sure that the resources are really focused on student outcomes and desired goals. And so I think it's a very different strategy or approach that our legislature has chosen to take. And so my hope is that the conversations that play out will be substantially different. I need to just say, though, that, you know, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, a number of communities where we know that the communities are really struggling fiscally. We know that they have real challenges maintaining systems to both support their schools, pay their teachers, and just make sure that they're delivering curriculum. And I think we need to just, you know, make sure that what we think we're doing well really is working for all of our kids. You know, we're a state that has you know, has challenges now with declining enrollment. It's part of this broader trend. And it's not just student enrollment. It's working families as well. We know that as the baby boomers age out of our workforce, we're going to be left with a population that has many, many fewer working adults who are really the ones who are generating the revenue and supporting our schools because they're paying at those higher rates, we assume. And so we really need to ask ourselves long-term, are we creating education in a way that's sustainable, but also is it equitable? And if there are systems that are truly struggling and are looking for opportunities to partner and are cutting programs, cutting supports, cutting opportunities to learn because they can't afford it and they're not big enough, is that really what we want in Vermont? Can we really afford to let those schools go down to make sure that somebody else doesn't have to change? And I think that this bill is asking people just to weigh that and just to see if maybe by thinking a little bit more broadly about community, they could do something. And I will point out that in some of these places, these are buildings that are sitting, in some cases, 4 miles apart in a paved road. We have communities where children on school buses drive past schools in other districts. They actually have a longer bus ride because they have to go to their own school in their own town, but pass by a closer elementary school that's run by a different district. So, I hear that, but the complexity is tremendous. And what people need to do is sit down locally and just say, what is it we want for our kids? What are the outcomes we're concerned about? And if we could draw this from scratch, what would it look like? And they may come down to maintaining what they have. They may also decide, as folks in Chittenden East did, that actually thinking a little bit more broadly about community has enabled them to get a whole new kind of leverage on using their resources to do better for their children. And so that's the kind of conversation we're really asking people to have.
Today on the program, our guest is Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb. Our number is 1-800-639-2211 if you've got a question or a comment about education in Vermont. So let's start off with Donna in South Burlington. Hi, Donna. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you very much. I have question about what the role of the supervisory unions are for budgeting within, you know, within school districts. I've had a lot of trouble figuring out. My understanding is that there's a state law now that says that the costs of special education are at the supervisory union level and not at the individual school district. So how does the budgeting, how do decisions about how are they supposed to be made? I mean, how are decisions made, you know, when you have all these different school districts, each with their own school board, you know, but they're all under one supervisory union? I really don't understand how that is supposed to work.
I think that's a wonderful question, and if it's okay, I'll take advantage of it to just clarify something that I hear is a source of confusion for many people, if not for you. And people need to understand, to really take advantage of this conversation, the difference between a supervisory union and a supervisory district. A supervisory union, the way we think of it, it's sort of a federal system, and it embraces a number of smaller school districts, all with their own boards, and the SU board is oversees, it's sort of a federal arrangement, and they oversee decisions related to joint activities. And the individual districts contract with that supervisory board for the provision of certain services. And over time, it's interesting, I think it's important to remember that Act 46 is really an evolution. It's not a discontinuous break with the past. The legislature has been moving several functions up to that supervisory level for years. And right now, transportation decisions and special education are supposed to be coordinated across that entire supervisory union and all the member districts, because there's a fair amount of research that suggests that those are functions that really are more efficiently and strategically delivered if you can take advantage of scale. So some of those functions are already seated at the supervisory level in supervisory unions. In contrast, a supervisory district is a unified district that may have member sites and schools. So that would be the new modified union up in Mount Mansfield. But the decisions or the seat of governance is at the supervisory level, and it operates as one district with one tax rate and one school board, one set of policies, one strategic agenda, and then control is at the school board level, and they're holding the superintendent accountable for delivering on that goal, those goals, and those sets of outcomes. I don't know if that helps, Donna, but I think what the superintendent is tasked to do in both systems is coordinate delivery of services related to special education, transportation, and curriculum instruction as well.
Today in the program, we're looking at education in Vermont with Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb and looking at the law that just passed the legislature this past session. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb, and we're talking about the new law that passed the legislature this past session. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you got some questions about how this law is going to work. We'd love to hear from you today, 1-800-639-2211. I know there's some people listening who are really concerned. They have the perception that this law is going to lead to the closing of some of Vermont's smaller schools. We got this email earlier today saying, this may save you a few dollars, but you might as well start closing your town when you lose the school. Then you lose gas stations, banks, grocery stores, and many other businesses. There is that concern out there among many people that the school is kind of the center focal point of the town. And if you take that away, you're taking away part of the town's identity. So let's just start with the perception to start with. Do you think this law will inevitably lead to the closing of some smaller schools in Vermont?
I have to tell you that we are in the process of seeing places where some small schools are discussing closing now. So I think that is a potential possibility regardless of this law. And part of the challenge that we see and what we're hearing from our superintendents is that when a system is beginning to cut a lot of programs, it becomes a less attractive place for families to move. So if you offer a small elementary school program and you don't have any art anymore, you don't have music, where you're not able to provide supports for your teachers to do professional development and learning, so you may have higher turnover, where you don't have access to foreign languages, but then your kids are going on to systems where they're mixing with kids who've had all those opportunities. Parents who can choose to do so, and these tend to also, unfortunately, be parents with more means, choose to avoid your community. And the problem is that sets you up in a situation where you may actually accelerate your declining enrollments. And that is something that we're very, very worried about statewide. And I understand that people are worried about that. And I think the question we have to ask is it fair to ask a school of 15 kids to save a community, or is there another way to think about this problem? Because we do see that there are places that are looking at that potential. And again, you know, we've been speaking to superintendents, we've been speaking to school board members all over the state, and what we're hearing is that it is more likely that there will be small schools in larger districts because there are ways to achieve economies of scale in larger districts with small schools that that can't be done when your small school is nested in a very, very small single district, single school district. And that's something that I know is very hard to believe, but I really encourage our community members all over the state to talk to people who've been experimenting and grappling with this challenge to hear what they've discovered. And so I think it is a real issue. My question back is, you know, when you're already serving 70% fewer students than you were 20 years ago, and it doesn't look like those declines are going away, what's your end game? I mean, and at what point are you so small that you really need to look for another option? And isn't it better to try to find some way to skin this cat differently so you can create opportunities for your kids and maybe turn that around now so that you actually do have a future? Because if you don't, what's going to happen is you may lose your school entirely, and then you also lose any kind of local control at all. And you'll be paying tuition to whatever school is still standing, and they'll get the benefit of their revenue, your revenue, and they will also have the right to make decisions that you really don't have a voice in. And what we do see statewide is that the towns that tuition students at every level, pre-kindergarten through 12th grade, are actually the most expensive systems right now, and they're also the systems with no local control at all.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to James, who's calling from Cabot. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Well, hello. I'm a resident in Cabot and a former teacher here as well. And I teach in St. Jay now, but we have about 150 kids through 12, and I certainly defer to the secretary when it comes to the longer-term budgetary concerns with phantom students. But I did want to speak to the quality of education point. I think we are able to be really nimble in Cabot and cater almost to the individual level when it comes to differentiation. And furthermore, the students, for example, just finished a June term of 2 weeks where they got to choose new subjects that teachers taught their passions outside the subject area. And we even did a musical a couple years ago that all 58 high school kids were involved in. And finally, I think we were first or second in the state in terms of sending kids on to college. And I guess my point is, isn't there something potentially lost in that ability to be nimble and furthermore, something gained by being able to have those smaller classes and catered classes that often we don't get an opportunity to find until we, you know, get to a liberal arts college education. So I'm wondering if the secretary can speak to those points as well.
Right. Well, I'm always thrilled when someone comes in and talks about quality, and I think Cabot has worked really hard to take advantage of other legislation, including Act 77, to try to put together project-based learning. Pretty exciting opportunities for individualization and personalization, and I think that's wonderful. I think that there are several issues that we need to talk about here, and this is a really good way to do this. I think in Vermont, because there are so many school districts that only have one school, we tend to conflate schools with districts, and we think they're the same thing. They are not the same thing. And what really makes Cabot such a vital school is the interaction of the school and the tremendous teachers and the students around the learning and with the community around them. And that's what makes that such a powerful community. At the same time, Cabot does have some challenges. I think about 7 or 8% of their population is actually phantom students at this point from funding sources. So they are also looking at tax increases. We also know that Cabot is struggling with some of the facilities. It's a fantastic program and in some deteriorating buildings. And we need to find a way to make sure all of our kids are in safe, structurally sound, and appealing buildings. And then the other thing just to point out is all small towns are not the same. I think Cabot has been able to take advantage in part because of its proximity to other centers of activity. It has a lot of community resources that it can really draw on, you know, in the business community, in the arts community, in terms of the very high level of investment in human capital of its parents to really support and sustain some pretty exciting projects. Not all small schools have that. And so they may have a fundamentally different set of questions to address and answer. And then the other reality is every school, and, you know, it's you know, I'm a parent of two children, and they're very, very different, even though they came out of the same family. And what they love is totally different, and what works for them in school is totally different. And, you know, one of the challenges of some of our small schools is you can be an absolutely fantastic program for 90% of your kids. And if they're, you know, they're kids who it doesn't work for, you know, what do you do for them? And I would just put that back because, you know, you're sitting in a district that's next to another district with another small high school that also has a very strong sense of investment in its community and has worked very hard to develop student voice. And merging governance means you merge around shared goals and commitments to certain kinds of outcomes that could be nimbleness, agility, and personalization of learning. But it also gives you a little bit more stable revenue and a little bit more of an ability to withstand the kinds of economic shocks that happen with small fluctuations in enrollment. And it also allows different schools within your system to specialize and maybe gives kids who, however wonderful your school is, might actually prefer to be at the other campus. So in a bigger district, you could actually offer opportunities for high school choice, for example, within your district that would allow Cabot to specialize so well in what it does well and what it's so passionate about, allows the other school to do the same, and lets kids have some depth of in terms of the kinds of choices that they can make that they don't currently have. And I'm not saying that's what you should do. That's the conversation that your community is going to have. And I know that you will do it with the student outcomes and the student success at the heart, because that is what your community does. What I wouldn't want is that to take away from the reality that some other communities that are small and rural don't have that outside support and nest of opportunities that you're able to capitalize on.
This law has several goals. We've been talking about change in governance and providing additional educational opportunities. It's also designed to reduce property tax burdens in the short term and the long term. Now, in the short term, the approach is something called a variable spending threshold. It allows towns to spend more money on education, but there's a penalty if they exceed certain growth rates. For towns that currently have a high per pupil spending rate, the growth rate could be down around 1%. And for communities that have lower per student spending, the growth rate could be 3 or 4%. And if towns spend more than the allotted growth rate, then they will be penalized by the state. And here's how House Education Chairman Dave Sharp describes this new system.
It's a variable rate, and it's not a cap. What it is a high spending threshold. So communities can exceed these numbers, and they will pay more in taxes, and that additional payment in taxes will make the Ed Fund more robust and will reduce taxes across the board for all Vermonters.
You know, there are some people who think that this new variable spending threshold is actually unconstitutional because it makes it very difficult for low-spending towns to ever catch up to the high-spending towns because they'll have this penalty that they're going to have to pay. What are your thoughts about that?
I think, you know, we're looking at this. We'll be meeting with the ACLU to discuss this as well. And I would just encourage us to step back and I think we need to be thoughtful about what the drivers are of costs, and we need there are a lot of things that create variability or differences in spending that are sometimes in the control of districts, sometimes not. And what we do see is that in systems that, for example, serve larger numbers of students in poverty, systems that serve larger numbers of students who are English language learners, systems that may have, for whatever reason, maybe proximity to specialized services, may have a larger proportion of their students with a very special kind of disability. What we do see is there are drivers that may drive costs in some systems and make it a little bit more expensive to educate kids well in some systems than others. So some of the variability you see is a function of size. That is one of the biggest drivers of difference that we see, but it is also around the variability of the demographics of individual communities. And this is we'll be watching this closely to see how this this plays forward. This wasn't part of the governor's particular set of recommendations, but we will work closely with the legislature and with all parties to make sure that we are delivering and supporting education in a way that's equitable and achieves the intention of our Constitution, but also the goals of quality and equity for our students.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Morris, who's calling from Benson. Hi, Morris. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you very much. I'd like to pick up on that last point that the speaker made. The Vermont Constitution says that it is the role of the state to provide an education for students, and the Vermont Supreme Court has said that that opportunity has to be equal. Is it likely that this bill will result in a better or more equal distribution? Because now a town that wants to spend more has a devotion to education, maybe like Cabot is doing a great job. Another town like my town is not. And so as a result, if I happen to live here, my students don't get the same quality of education as they would if they lived someplace else. Yet it is the role of the state and not the town to provide this education.
We are a local control state, though, and the communities are the entities that make the decisions about how we deliver education. Our funding formula substantially equalizes the ability of those communities to raise revenues per pupil. At the bottom, you know, the bottom line is that if you're a community that's very small with 100 students, you can spend $14,000 per student. You will have a lot less to work with, and the full basket of opportunities you're able to buy is narrower than if you are a community with 300 students spending $14,000 per student. So, you know, there's two sides to this, and this is, I think, the intent of the legislature is to try to challenge our communities to think about, even with relative funding equity, and we've done analyses this way and that, and part of the adequacy of this study this summer, we'll also be looking at whether our funding weighting is substantial enough for students in poverty and students who are English language learners, for example. But the other side of equity is not what you spend, but how you spend it. And that really is still the responsibility of our local boards to ask whether the way they're choosing to spend money really is serving those goals of substantial equity. And I think that is the intent of this bill, is to challenge every community to ask that question. I mean, I question, you know, we do have areas where we're spending our resources to maintain class sizes of 7.5 to 1, you know, 7.5 students to one teacher. There's no empirical literature anywhere that I can find that says that that actually improves outcomes for kids, and we don't see that in our own Vermont data. What we do know is that every decision a school board makes is a trade-off, and you can choose to maintain class sizes of 7.5, or you can choose to maintain class sizes of 15, which is what the literature suggests is optimal, and provide summer programming that makes sure that kids living in poverty have access to food over the summer months, have access to the kinds of rich enrichment opportunities that more affluent kids get through, you know, summer robotics camps and engineering and the kinds of vacations that their parents bring them on. Or you can choose, you know, again, you can choose to maintain your class size of 7.5 at the expense of that equity. So this is, again, what we have is an extraordinary opportunity as a state to say, if we believe in quality and equity and we're spending more than any other state per pupil, how are we spending these resources, and are we really making decisions that serve those shared goals and commitments, or are there ways to partner with each other to maybe enhance our ability to achieve those goals? And when I was talking to the Superintendent John Alberghini up in Chittenden East, he said that one paradox of moving governance from the local boards up to the supervisory level in a new unified district was that, in his opinion, it really enhanced local control because the boards are actually now focused on what matters in terms of student outcomes and the systematic delivery of equitable opportunities to learn across all the towns in the district. And that by pooling resources, they've been able to manage their resources much more effectively to achieve those goals. So we have to ask hard what we mean when we talk about local control.
We're almost out of time, but in the next 30 seconds or so, is one of your goals in the next 12 months to get out and continue to meet with local school officials so they understand what the reality is going forward?
Yes, and it's funny you mentioned that, because next week I think I have now scheduled meetings with 30 different SUs who've reached out. The VSA and the Vermont School Boards Association have convened these meetings for individual school boards, supervisory boards, to come and meet with us and talk to us about what their hopes are and how they hope to attain it. And we'll be visiting boards across the state and trying to just support, provide assistance where possible, and support this conversation.
We'll certainly be following how this new law gets implemented. Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, I'll talk with former Governor Madeleine Kunin about the Hillary Clinton for President campaign in Vermont. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There's been a lot of attention in recent weeks about Senator Bernie Sanders' bid to win the Democratic presidential nomination. Sanders is beginning to rise in some polls in states with early primaries, and he's drawing big crowds in these states. There's also a large group of Vermont Democrats who are supporting the candidacy of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Governor Peter Shumlin and Senator Patrick Leahy are some of the political leaders supporting Clinton. And one person who strongly supported Hillary Clinton in 2008 and who is enthusiastically backing her again this year is former Governor Madeleine Kunin. And Governor Kunin joins us right now. Governor, it's great to have you on the program.
Great to be back with you, Bob.
So, Governor, why is Hillary Clinton your choice to be the next president of the United States? What is it about her candidacy that you find so appealing?
Well, I think if you could be partisan blind and just objectively look at her qualifications, there's no doubt in my mind, and I think many people's minds, that she is the most qualified person to be president of the United States. You know, her experience in foreign policy, her experience as a senator, her experience even as a spouse who witnessed everything that happened, if not firsthand, certainly secondhand. And I both know her both personally and from a, I would hope, objective political perspective. She's smart. She's a quick study. She's much more sociable and warm than can be put across sometimes on television or in the media. So, and I guess as a footnote, I have to add, I have always wanted to live to see a woman raise her right hand and take the oath to become president of the United States. It would be a huge historic moment. It would be a justified historic moment. I mean, a lot of people think, hey, it's about time we had a woman president.
Governor, a recent CNN poll showed Hillary Clinton with an unfavorable rating of 52%. Does that concern you?
Well, sure. But, you know, she's been around a long time. And when you're around a long time, you make some enemies, especially if you take action. But I think, you know, it depends where that 52% comes from. I'd like to see the figure amongst Democrats, because what we're really talking here is the first step, winning the Democratic nomination. And I think as the campaign unfolds, as people realize what a capable woman we're talking about, those figures will change, and I certainly suspect they're much stronger for Democrats. But, you know, we're living in a very cynical time when politicians aren't trusted by anybody the way they used to be. And there's just a suspicion abroad, you know, are you real? Are you telling the truth? What are you hiding? And I think this cloud hangs over every candidate who sticks her or his neck out and says, I want to get your vote. You know, are you really genuine? I think that's the major question. And with all the negative signals we're getting and all the bad stories about corruption, people start out with suspicion, and you have to prove to them that you're clean.
Are you at all surprised that Bernie Sanders is rising in some polls in the early primary states and he's drawing big, big crowds over in New Hampshire?
Well, yes and no. You know, what's in a way, I'm surprised because, you know, none of us knew how his message would resonate outside of Vermont. But I think he is a very good speaker, and he's very direct. You know, he tells you what he thinks. The big question, and he's hitting the issues which Hillary will put in center place as well. You know, the economy, the growing gap between the rich and poor. And Bernie has been saying that ever since he ran against me. I think it was like 32 years ago in my second term. And what's changed is that the economic climate has not only caught up with his rhetoric, it's exceeded his rhetoric. So while he's been saying the same thing, the situation has actually become more acute, that the rich are even richer, and the middle class, not only the poor, is falling behind. So that message resonates. I think a lot of people like to hear that message. He's making a lot of promises. And the question will be, is he really qualified? But I'm glad he's running. I think he will liven up the debate, certainly. And I think he'll really underline and emphasize these central issues, which is good for the country.
Some people think having Bernie Sanders in the race will move Hillary Clinton in those debates more to the left on these economic issues. Do you think that's true?
I don't think she needs anybody to move her, frankly. I think she's already there. Now, there still will be a difference. I mean, what Hillary has to do two things, of course. She has to win the primary, and she has to win the general election. Bernie is focused on the primary, and he is not looking – he may be, but my observation – he can go as far left as he wants and then worry later whether he can attract the middle. Hillary still has to attract some centrist positions and voters. And also, you know, a matter of style. He can be flamboyant, but if a woman had that kind of style, we'd be very put off. I mean, again, there go the gender stereotypes. A man can shout. A man can be extreme and not be considered hysterical. If a woman had that same kind of style, she would be considered hysterical.
What do you think it's going to take to end those kinds of gender stereotypes?
You know, I wish I knew the answer to that. I think the broad answer is the more women we see in leadership, not only in politics, but in business, in education, the less that stereotype will have to stand, because women like men do have different styles. We're not in cookie cutter shape. So I think the more you see, the more you get. And I think we also have to kind of remind ourselves, even women, am I stereotyping this person? Do I expect something different from a woman than I expect a man? I think deep in our subconscious, we have a photo that's similar to the photos on the front page, that's similar to the photos that are in state houses and courthouses, that leadership equals male. And that male picture is the first thing we visualize. And then you have to blink and say, hey, wait a minute, here's a different kind of leadership. Would that person be as capable as the men who have led us for thousands of years? So it's kind of a click that has to occur in your mind, and you have to broaden your mind and say, yeah, we can do it effectively with a different cast, with a female cast.
And finally, Governor, in the coming weeks and months, what role will you play in Hillary Clinton's campaign, both here in Vermont or perhaps nationally or in New Hampshire? What do you have planned?
Well, my plans are fluid right now. We have, you know, 18 months to go, but I will do everything I can to help Hillary Clinton get elected president of the United States. In the past, I've gone to New Hampshire, and I've gone to some other parts of the country. So I will do that, again, as much as I'm able, because I really believe deeply that she is the right person for us at this time in history, and that the time has come not to elect any woman. I would never vote for just any woman at all, but I believe she is the strongest woman and the most capable. And I would add the word compassionate. I mean, her concentration on children's issues, on education, on early childhood, on child care, on paid family leave, these are now the gut issues for families. And with her at the helm, we will get them done.
Former Governor Madeleine Kunin, great talking to you, and many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you so much, Bob.
And you can follow more coverage of the presidential campaigns at vpr.net. That's Vermont Edition for today. Join us on Monday when we check on the issues that have troubled the state's child protection system over the past year. The deaths of two toddlers under state supervision led to several investigations and reviews centered on the Department for Children and Families. We'll learn what's changed in the last year Monday on Vermont Edition. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.